We are comforted by the thought that we progress morally as a species. We want things to get better. We want to believe we are moving forward. This hope is more reassuring than reality. All the signs in our present world, however, point to a coming anarchy, a massive dislocation of populations that will result from ecological devastation and climate change, multiple pollutions, the weight of overpopulation, and wars fought over dwindling natural resources. Science, which should be used to address these looming disasters, has largely become a tool of corporations that seek not to protect us, but make a profit and stimulate the economy. New technologies that are potentially threatening, such as genetically modified organisms and nanotechnologies, are being unleashed with no understanding of the impact on the biosphere. The global population, if left unchecked, we will no longer be able to sustain ourselves, especially as nations such as China achieve the consumption levels of the industrialized nations in Europe and North America. Nearly two-thirds of the life support services provided to us by nature are already in precipitous decline worldwide. And the old wars of conquest, expansion, and exploitation will be replaced by wars fought for the basic necessities of air, food, sustainable living conditions, and water. And as we race towards this catastrophe, scientists continue to make discoveries, set these discoveries upon us, and walk away from the impact.
You do not have to be livestock. Nationalism is pimped out bigotry, designed to provoke a Stockholm syndrome in the livestock. Statism is an ideology, and all ideologies are variations on human livestock management practices.
Let me explain this. If you're looking at any economy in history, the question is, who's going to get the economic surplus? Now, in antiquity, governments absorbed the surplus as taxes. They taxed everybody, and they used it mainly to set up an army and wage wars. An alternative would be in feudal times, the government invaded countries like the Norman invasion of England. They divided it up the land and gave it to the landlords. Well, the landlords took as much of the surplus as they could for themselves and kept it in the form of rent to become rich. They didn't want to pay taxes to the government, and so they forced the government to borrow. So the government borrowed, and because labor didn't make enough to pay many taxes, and landlords wouldn't, they borrowed and they created monopolies, like the South Sea Company and the East India Companies, to get monopoly profit. So you had economic rent of landlords, you had monopoly profit from government taxes is the main uses of the surplus. Well, gradually, countries had to compete by setting up industry. So industry wanted to use the economic surplus as much as possible for capital formation. The problem was that labor fought against this, and they wanted to use the economic surplus as much as possible for rising in living standards. Well, industry had some interest in this because higher paid labor was more productive labor, it was more efficient labor, and also paying labor more enabled it to become an internal market to buy what the industry produced. So you had pretty much of a division of the economic surplus into taxes, into rents, into wages, and into industrial profits. But then increasingly, the financial sector wanted to load all of these groups down with debt and take as much as possible in the form of interest. For instance, it wanted to lend against the largest asset in any economy, which is real estate, and would make loans to real estate, and the developers or speculators or even home buyers would pledge pay out the rental value of the real estate and mortgage interest. And as the banks found that 70% of their loans in the United States and Canada and in England, our mortgage loans, they tried to get the real estate sector as immune from debt as possible. Back in 1930, real estate taxes made up about 70% of state and local revenue. Now they're down to 16%. And the financial sector and real estate have joined together to shift the tax burden on the labor. So gradually, the taxes have been shifted off what the classical economists wanted to place them on, land and monopoly rents and essentially on wealth, and they've been shifted onto labor, and this has made labor very high cost in countries that are becoming financialized. And the whole word financialization has been added to the English language recently to indicate an economy where ideally the bank marketing directors will get together and they'll say, our ideal is for people to pledge all their income, real estate to pledge all its income, and industry to pledge all its income for debt service. And the entire economic surplus in the economy is going to be paid for debt. And this is essentially what's been happening today.
And now, a short piece on the social essence of capitalism in terms that all can understand, written by Edward Bellamy in the latter part of the 19th century. He begins, "Perhaps I cannot do better than to compare society as it is to a prodigious coach, which the masses of humanity are harnessed to and dragged toilsomely along a very hilly and sandy road. The driver is hungry and permits no lagging, though the pace is necessarily very slow. Despite the difficulty of drawing the coach at all along so hard a road, the top is covered with passengers who never get down, even at the steepest ascents. These seats on top are very breezy and comfortable. Well up out of the dust, their occupants can enjoy the scenery at their leisure, or critically discuss the merits of the straying team. Naturally, such places are in great demand, and the competition for them is keen, everyone seeking as the first end in life to secure such a seat on the coach for themselves and to leave it to their child. By the rule of the coach, a man can leave his seat to whom he wishes, but on the other hand, there are many accidents by which it might at any time be wholly lost. For all that they are so easy, the seats are very insecure, and at every sudden jolt of the coach, persons are slipping out of them and falling to the ground, where they are instantly compelled to take hold of the rope and help to drag the coach on which they had before ridden so pleasantly. It is naturally regarded as a terrible misfortune to lose one's seat, and the apprehension that this might happen to them or their friends is a constant cloud upon the happiness of those who ride. But do they think only of themselves, you may ask? Is not their very luxury rendered intolerable to them by comparison with a lot of their brothers and sisters in the harness, and the knowledge that their own weight adds to their toil? Have they no compassion for fellow human beings from whom fortune only distinguished them? Oh yes, commiseration is frequently expressed by those who ride for those who have to pull the coach, especially when the vehicle comes to a bad place in the road, as it is constantly doing, or to a particularly steep hill. At such times, the desperate straining of the team, their agonized leaping and plunging under the pitiless lashing of hunger, the many who faint at the rope and are trampled in the mire, make a very distressing spectacle, which often calls forth highly credible displays of feeling on top of the coach. At such times, the passengers will call down, encouraging to the toilers of the rope, exhorting them to patience, and holding out hopes of possible compensation in another world for the hardness of their lot, while others contribute to buying salves and liniments for the crippled and injured. It is agreed that it is a great pity that the coach should be so hard to pull, and there is a sense of general relief when the especially bad piece of road is gotten over. This relief is not, indeed, wholly on account of the team, for there is always some danger at these bad places of a general overturn in which all would lose their seats. It must in truth be admitted that the main effect of the spectacle of the misery of the toilers at the rope is to enhance the passengers' sense of the value of their seats upon the coach, and to cause them to hold on to them more desperately than before. If the passengers could only feel assured that neither they nor their friends would ever fall from the top, it is probable that beyond contributing to the funds for liniments and bandages, they would trouble themselves extremely little about those who drive the coach. I am well aware that this will appear to the enlightened men and women of the 21st century as an incredible inhumanity. But there are two facts, both very precious, which partly explain it. In the first place, it is firmly and sincerely believed that there is no other way in which society can get along, except the many pull at the rope and the few ride. And not only this, but that no very radical improvement even is possible, either in the harness, the coach, the roadway, or in the distribution of the toil. It has always been as it is, and it always will be so. It is a pity, but it cannot be helped, and philosophy forbids wasting compassion on what is beyond remedy. The other fact is more curious, consisting in a singular hallucination, which those on the top of the coach generally share, that they are not exactly like their brothers and sisters who pull the rope, but are of a finer clay, in some way belonging to a higher order of beings who might justly expect to be drawn. This seems unaccountable, but as I once rode this very coach and shared that very hallucination, I know of what I speak and ought to be believed. The strangest thing about the hallucination is that those who have just climbed up from the ground, before they have outgrown the marks of the rope upon their skin, begin to fall under its influence quickly. As for those whose parents and grandparents before them have been so fortunate as to keep their seats on the top, the convictions they've cherished of the essential differences between their sort of humanity and the common article was absolute. The effect of such a delusion in moderating fellow feeling for the sufferings of the mass of men into a distant and philosophical compassion is obvious.
Those who believe in collective moral progress define this progress by their own narrow historical, cultural, linguistic, and social experience. They see others as equal only when the other is identical to themselves. They project their own values on the rest of the human race. Those who are different do not need to be investigated, understood, or tolerated, for they are intellectually and morally inferior. They are unable to accept human difference. Those who are different are imperfect versions of themselves. These secular and religious fundamentalists are blind egocentrics. They confuse their particular values with universal values. They confuse themselves with the universe. And these secular utopians, like Christian fundamentalists, are stunted products of a self-satisfied, materialistic middle class. They seek in their philosophical systems a moral justification for their own comfort, self-absorption, and power. They do not question the imperial projects of the nation, globalization, or the vast disparities in wealth and security between themselves as members of the world's industrialized elite and the rest of the planet. Philosophy, like theology, is often in the service of self-preservation and power, and this creed is no exception.
It's a brave new world.
If slavery is a choice, then I choose not to be a slave. This is the most frightening statement for the ruling classes, which is why they train their slaves to attack anyone who dares speak it.
You say bankers don't earn their money, they extract it.
That's right. It's rent and interest are what the classical economists called rentier income that should be minimized. And it's an unnecessary charge resulting from financial and property rights, not stemming from the means of production itself.
¶¶ filling in for Clifford Baines, who messed with the wrong people and got himself involved in some serious shit. With all economic factors indicating the U.S. is heading for a prolonged recession, some experts are suggesting that the government should stop dumping all of our money into an enormous hole. Is it time to close the national money hole?
That kind of talk is alarmist and irresponsible.
America needs the money hole.
Right. Driving truckloads of money out into the New Mexico desert and dumping it into a massive pit is one of America's greatest traditions.
It's frankly, it's a national
treasure. Look, reasonable person is advocating that we are going to stop destroying money. But the American people earn that money. They have the right to decide how it should be destroyed.
Well, so you are in favor of personal money holes.
Yes, people should be able to dump money into a hole in their backyard or flush it down the toilet. Let the free market decide the most efficient way of destroying money.
My father worked two jobs so he'd have money to put in the money hole, and he never complained.
Now, you can't depend on private money holes to destroy that money.
Duncan's right. I mean, some of this money could blow away.
Yes.
Some of it may not be correctly buried.
Burned,
I mean, there's too many variables.
That's why the government pours gasoline into the money hole and lights it on fire to make sure all the money is destroyed.
I love the money fire.
It's just like they say, you have to throw money in a hole and set it on fire to make money.
Okay, but find the cheapest way to destroy that money, like shredding it up and feeding it to hogs.
Tell that to the digger who's worked the graveyard shift for 20 years. Digging the hole is all he knows.
The sheer number of shovelers that it takes to maintain that hole.
But if we're talking about closing holes, I mean, what about the soldier hole? How about the energy hole? I mean, I can't believe that closing the money hole is even on the table.
Don't close the money hole.
Why are you pushing this pro-hole agenda? Is the money hole lobby paying you?
I resent that accusation. I do not take money from special interests. And if I did, I would throw it right in the hole because I am a patriot.
If you love America, you throw money in its hole.
Well, this is how parasitism works in nature. Most people think of parasites simply as something that attaches itself and sucks the blood or nourishment out of the host. But that wouldn't get parasites very far because they'd all be squashed. Every sophisticated parasite, in order to survive, needs to take over the brain of the host. And it needs to take over the brain so that the host thinks that the parasite is actually part of its own body. And in fact, even thinks of the parasite as a child to be taken care of. And so the parasite basically is a mind control thing. And finally, when it takes all the nourishment out of the host, it makes the host take big, dangerous acts to get the host eaten up. In this case, bailed out by the government or eaten by the government so that the parasite can jump from the host onto the party that eats the host, in this case onto the government's balance sheet. So if you study how parasitism works in biology, you'll get a clue to how it works in the economy at large.
Michael, I have no doubt that they are going to make things much worse in this country under Obama. And we do it to all developing countries. We keep them deeply in debt. They can never get out of it. Once in a while, a country like Argentina goes bankrupt. But we manage to find a way out of that. Occasionally, they get a little gumption, and they'll at least partially default on their debt. But we even did it to post-apartheid South Africa under Nelson Mandela, who was elected to really bring change to that country. And if Nelson Mandela couldn't do it after spending 25 years in prison, he surrendered. I quoted his exact words on what he said when he was confronted point blank. Why did you do this? And he basically said something like, well, Thatcherism is the way for South Africa. In other words, play the game and keep the people impoverished. And they're in worse shape now economically than they were under apartheid.
I think that he probably believed that the free markets would work, and they don't realize that every successful economy in history has been a mixed economy. The Soviet countries realized that an economy run entirely by the government didn't have checks and balances and ended up just a bureaucracy that became a kleptocracy itself. But by moving to the opposite extreme, they left a kleptocracy in place. Maybe a new one, and neither extreme works. You need a system of checks and balances. And the financial sectors usually fought against this because the system of checks and balances essentially seeks to use the economic surplus to plow into capital formation and rising living standards, not into debt service, not into land rent, and not really into taxes, as long as the government provides a regulatory and planning system. So the whole idea of economic balance has been thrown off by this neoliberalism that really is the opposite of everything that Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill and the classical economists talked about. Their idea of free markets was to free markets from rent and interest, is unnecessary social costs. Their idea was to make prices reflect actual cost value, that is, a cost of production that was necessary, and rent isn't necessary and interest isn't necessary for a cost of production. It's superimposed. And so about 100 years ago, there was a post-classical reaction sponsored especially by Columbia University in this country with John Bates Clark, Harvard, and Yale, all opposed the German institutionalist and social democratic approach that went hand in hand with the progressive era, and began to push a kind of junk economics on the country that didn't look at finance, didn't look at rent at all, that defined all income as being productive. So the national income accounts of this country and other countries don't have, on the one hand, earned income, and on the other, economic overhead in the form of rent and interest. They treat Wall Street's gains as contributing to gross national product, and all is wealth creation, where what it really is debt creation. And so we have a whole system of economic accounts that depict all of this economic parasitism is actually being part of wealth creation and rising output, and of course it isn't at all. It's just the opposite.
Você não vai me acertar a queima-roupa. Vem cá, me deixa fugir. Me beija a boca. Às vezes parece até.
The only true, lasting American value that's left, buying things. Buying things. People spending money they don't have on things they don't need. Money they don't have on things they don't need so they can max out their credit cards and spend the rest of their lives paying 18% interest on something that costs $12.50. And they didn't like it when they got it home anyway. Not too bright, folks. Not too fucking bright. But if you talk to one of them about this, if you isolate one of them, you sit them down rationally and you talk to them about the low IQs and the dumb behavior and the bad decisions, right away they start talking about education. That's the big answer to everything. Education. They said we need more money for education. We need more books, more teachers, more classrooms, more schools. We need more testing for the kids. You say to them, well, you know, we've tried all of that and the kids still can't pass the test. They say, oh, don't you worry about that. We're going to lower the passing grades. And that's what they do in a lot of these schools now. They lower the passing grades so more kids can pass. More kids pass, the school looks good, everybody's happy, the IQ of the country slips another 2 or 3 points, and pretty soon all you'll need to get into college is a fucking pencil. Got a pencil? Get the fuck in there. It's physics. Then everyone wonders why 17 other countries graduate more scientists than we do. Education! Politicians know that word. They use it on you. Politicians have traditionally hidden behind three things: the flag, the Bible, and children. No child left behind. No child left behind. Oh, really? Well, it wasn't long ago you were talking about giving kids a head start. Head start, left behind. Someone's losing fucking ground here. But there's a reason. There's a reason. There's a reason for this. There's a reason education sucks, and it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. It's never going to get any better. Don't look for it. Be happy with what you got. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The big, the wealthy, that the real owners, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. They're irrelevant. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media news, all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the balls. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table to figure out how badly they're getting fucked by a system that threw them overboard 30 fucking years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly shittier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your fucking retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this fucking place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club. By the way, it's the same big club they use to beat you over the head with all day long when they tell you what to believe. All day long, beating you over the head in their media, telling you what to believe, what to think, and what to buy. The table is tilted, folks. The game is rigged, and nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. Good, honest, hardworking people, white collar, blue collar, doesn't matter what color shirt you have on. Good, honest, hardworking people continue. These are people of modest means. Continue to elect these rich cocksuckers who don't give a fuck about them. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't care about you at all. At all. At all. Yeah. You know? And nobody seems to notice, nobody seems to care. That's what the owners count on, the fact that Americans will probably remain willfully ignorant of the big red, white, and blue dick that's being jammed up their assholes every day. Because the owners of this country know the truth. It's called the American dream, because you have to be asleep to believe it. But say what you want about American folks. Yeah. You can say what you want about Americans. You can call them smart, dumb, ignorant, innocent, naive, gullible, easily led, whatever you want. You're going to have to deal with them. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club. By the way, it's the same big club they use to beat you over the head with all day long when they tell you what to believe. All day long, beating you over the head in their media, telling you what to believe, what to think, and what to buy. The table is tilted, folks. The game is rigged, and nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. Good, honest, hardworking people, white collar, blue collar, doesn't matter what color shirt you have on. Good, honest, hardworking people continue. These are people of modest means. Continue to elect these rich cocksuckers who don't give a fuck about them. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't care about you at all. At all. At all. Man. You know?
Well, it's a remarkable system. I mean, I think the United States is the most successfully repressed country in the world, in the sense that the people think they have a free and independent press, and it's not. The people think the government does respond, and it doesn't. The people all distrust politicians, and you say, what do you think of these people? Oh, they're a bunch of crooks. Oh, they're... They have their friends, and they are all special influence peddlers and all that. But when those very same politicians start talking about an alien enemy, then they just lovingly rally around, follow him off the edge of the cliff into one abyss or another. So it's a very clever system. They're distracted by more and more puffery. They know more about Britney Spears than they do about their city council budget or anything like that. But you know, the truth is, if they gave it some time, the city council budget is more interesting than Britney Spears. Crashing bore. What the hell? What the hell we got to hear about her? Is she wearing this hat? Is she wearing that hat?
She's pregnant again?
Or she went into rehab? Yeah, well, what the hell is that all about?
Don't know. You tell me. You're American. The other thing that's that they, the question that they ask, and I hear even people that are progressive ask this question, you know, why do they hate us?
Well, some of the more politically literate people in other parts of the world make it clear that they don't hate the American people. They hate what the government is doing to the global economy and to their particular country and to their livelihoods and all that. Why wouldn't the Iraqis hate us? They had a country that had the highest standard of living in the Middle East just 5 years ago, and today it's totally devastated. Mm-hmm. 4 or 5 million refugees have gone off into other countries living total destitution. Power systems can't, you know, that work 2 hours a day. 40% unemployment in Iraq. People dying here caught in these horrible wars, some of them from competing Islamic sects, others from U.S. sources. I mean, U.S. has been backing terror groups in Iraq to terrorize the population. They call it the Salvadoran solution.
Mm-hmm. Salvadoran option.
The Salvadoran option, right, thank you. So they're rather upfront about that. Of course they'll hate us, why wouldn't they?
I'm Juliana Bacanus, filling in for Clifford Baines, who told me to say hello to all of you. A recent poll finds that many Capitol Hill lobbyists are fed up with politicians accepting their money and then not coming through with promised legislation. Are politicians failing our lobbyists?
The voice of the corporate lobbyist has long been ignored by the politicians.
Nowadays, as soon as the politicians get in office, they forget whose money put them there.
That's right. These lobbyists are going out every single day making sure that their corporate sponsorship is getting
through. But I don't think that we can just blame the members of Congress. I mean, honestly, I think the lobbyists have to stand up for themselves.
Oh, great, Duncan. Now we're blaming the lobbyists?
Well, I'm just saying that they need to stand up and not let these politicians walk all over them.
You know what? I'm going to agree with Duncan, because if they don't like the legislation that a politician is passing, that they need to find a different politician who will do what they want and accept tens of millions of dollars to fall in line with the lobbyists.
But they're doing everything they're supposed to be doing.
Saying,
they are paying millions, and they're not being listened to.
If you make a deal, you make a deal.
Since politicians are so unreliable, should lobbyists just cut out the middleman and start giving their money directly to voters?
Yes, pay the voters. Forget about the greedy politicians.
My rates?
Right.
$50 on the local vote, $75 for a national vote.
Oh, that's nothing.
What, are you
nothing.
Serious?
$500 is my lowest. $500.
It depends on what state I'm living in at the time.
An article in The Economist this week argues that nations also should cut out the middleman, and they should just put corporations in office.
Yeah. That could improve our image abroad.
Yeah, I personally respond to logos, and I would love to have a president that is identified more by a logo, you know, some
Wouldn't
kind of little
sweet?
Shape, you mm-hmm. know, like some kind of amorphous blob.
1, 2, 3, 4. Coal fires burning, deforestation, cookie cutter houses, no reparation. Cars, cars everywhere, highways, asphalt, pop cans, strip mining, extracting cobalt. Industrial civilization is a pyramid scheme. Industrial civilization is a pyramid scheme. Just waiting for the benefits to be seen. Pasture pigeons, sea turtles, prairie dogs, dodo, red wolf, black bear, bald eagle, buffalo, no habitat extinction, bison, salmon. Millions of species are gone, gone, gone. Industrial civilization is a pyramid scheme. Industrial civilization is a pyramid scheme. Just waiting for the benefits to be seen. Rich folks like stealing all the resources, pouring global south off, feeling it the worst. Promises, promises, we'll get our share. The planet we live on gets stripped bare. Industrial civilization is a pyramid scheme. Industrial civilization is a pyramid scheme. Just waiting for the benefits to be seen. Just waiting for the benefits to be seen. Just waiting for the benefits to be seen. Just waiting for the benefits.
To be waiting. You mentioned that you'd come back from Germany and there was consensus among a group of economists you got together with that we are heading into a depression, and I guess the environment is very deflationary now. Along with that, it strikes me that at some point in time, you didn't seem to think so, but it strikes me that at some point in time, we face a very severe inflation problem because of all this money that's been created. It's not doing very much. It's just sitting in the banks right now for the most part. But on the one hand, the notion of a deflationary depression, and on the other hand, the possibility that we're talking about at some point in time a serious inflation. Your thoughts on that?
You're going to have both at once. There'll be debt deflation in the sense that more and more income is taken away from salaries and corporate cash flow and paid to the banks. So you're going to have a shortage of purchasing power for goods and services. At the same time, foreign countries, now that foreign investors are not buying U.S. companies anymore, they realize that they're going to lose money on U.S. stocks and bonds. They're not buying U.S. exports because we've post-industrialized the economy. So the dollar is likely to go down very sharply against foreign currencies. This means that the price of imports will rise, and import prices form an umbrella over domestic prices. So you're going to have a rise in the cost of living without really an inflation taking place, in the face of debt deflation, in fact. So you're going to get a squeeze on labor and on industry that's going to essentially wipe out the economic surplus. The surplus will be taken more by finance and property than by industry, so you're not going to have industrial investment. You're not going to have consumer spending on rising in living standards, and you're not going to have the foreigners giving America the free ride that they've been given by essentially accumulating $4 trillion worth of these U.S. Treasury bonds that you've talked about. Foreigners have been financing most of the U.S. Budget deficit by recycling the balance of payments deficit into a Treasury bond holding. That probably is too many words for people who haven't followed the balance of payments to follow. But basically, the balance of payments is in a bad deficit. And if the dollar is falling while there's debt deflation here, you're going to have the prices that people pay rise while their incomes are not rising. And while they have to pay more and more money for debt, for local taxes, for health care, and essentially for monopoly prices generally. So there's a squeeze on.
Now, it's time for This Billionaire Moment.
When human rights groups discover that our third world sweatshops employ a lot of child labor, they're always horrified. These children should be in school, they stridently insist. But why would these kids be better off sitting at a desk learning about social studies than working on our assembly lines? Schools are supposed to prepare you for the future. In most of the places we do business, the only future these moppets have is on an assembly line. What better way for them to prepare than in our sweatshop apprentice program? The kids get paid a special introductory wage while they learn all the skills they'll need for the rest of their short, miserable lives. And those little hands can do some really intricate stitching, believe me. This has been Xenophobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Here come the billionaires!
And I think what's going on with the so-called auto bailout is a good example of how workers will be deeply affected by this.
We don't know whether they'll accept the terms. The terms are that unionization has to be broken, that the labor movement in America will be fractured, and that they will have to give up the gains and essentially become reduced to the level they were over a century ago, before things were scaled back. And so the first change Mr. Obama wants to do is roll back American history to the position it was before the Progressive Era, destroy the labor union movement, and reduce American workers to serfdom. That's quite a change. I hope the people who voted for him are happy with it.
Oh, well, I agree with you 100%. And they can do it incrementally, Michael.
No, it has to be done incrementally. It has to be done all at once in a step function. You can't do it bit by bit. That's not how society works. When living standards and income goes back, it's a very, very sharp fall. The decline has to be at least 20% in living standards. Life life spans have to shorten very dramatically in this country, as they did in Russia. And if we repeat the Russian experience that Mr. Summers used at the dress rehearsal, you'll have rising alcoholism, rising sickness, very bad health, layoffs, beggars. That's the plan that the economic administrators that Mr. Obama has appointed tried out in Russia as a dress rehearsal, and it's being repeated now in the post-Soviet economies, the Baltic states and Hungary. And if you just do the charts and the mathematics, that's what the mathematics add up to.
Last year I wrote about what we did to Russia and how it impoverished the people. An absolutely devastating story. In terms of the auto workers, Michael, I'm thinking about the last labor contract that the UAW agreed to, got the rank and file to vote to approve it. And one of the things they did to get wages down was they came up with a two-tier system. The existing senior employees would continue on their present pay, but all new hires would be hired for half what the senior people are getting.
That's the logical result of a labor movement that's organized along craft movement lines, along particular industry lines, instead of an overall labor package. And these were the criticisms levied already in the 1910s against the AFL.
Producing class. We live in a world shaped by human labor. Goods, services, money, capital. All represent units of human labor. Under capitalism, the working class does not produce for itself, but for the capitalist class. The capitalist forces the worker to exchange the collective power to produce for the individual, quote, power to consume. However, the real power of workers lies not in their wallets, but in their ability to stop producing for profit and to start producing for need. When the working class produces to meet its own needs, it also produces to meet humanity's needs, because the two are indistinguishable. By taking collective control of production, the working class could end class divisions and unite humanity in the common project of managing society, the international class. The international working class already runs the world for capitalism. Computers are manufactured by Chinese workers, assembled by Mexican workers, sold by American workers, and serviced by Indian workers. The working class is international. Every major city contains workers from many different nations. Youngsters around the world watch the same movies, listen to the same music, eat the same fast food, and wear the same clothes. However, the persistence of national borders prevents the global integration of humanity. By organizing across national borders, the working class could put an end to war and raise everyone's living standards. Unlike the capitalist class and the middle class, the working class has no interests that conflict with the interests of humanity as a whole. The greatest obstacle to majority rule is the belief that it would never work. Unfortunately, beliefs can change. The next chapter explores how the working class could take control of society. Summary: class divisions block humanity from solving pressing problems. The ruling class' obsession with profit endangers human survival. The middle class lacks the power to challenge the ruling class. Only the working class has the size, the organization, and the ability to free humanity from capitalism.
Olho na pressão, olho na panela, dinamite é o feijão dentro do molho dela. Olho na pressão.
Manufacturing are on the rise.
problem is that the economic managers are basically drawn from the financial sector. Wall Street has a veto power over whatever economist or administrator for the Treasury or the Federal Reserve is going to be appointed, and they usually have their own lobbyists, and that's what Summers is the new economic advisor. It's what the whole group of people who were put around Robert Rubin in Clinton's administration were doing. And the financial sector's objective is basically to get the entire economic surplus pledged as debt service and paid out as interest.
Come work for me under the hot, hot sun until the harvest done. You'll work night and day. A fake ID is what you're gonna need so you can get your lousy pay. We're having a race to the bottom. You'll work for 3 years from the day that you come. Then gracias for all your trabajo. There's no time to pack, 'cause we're sending you back to where you come from. Here, grab a saw. You're gonna cut some meat while standing on your feet without any break. Forget the law. The less I pay to you, the more my company can make. We're having a race to the bottom. You'll work till you bleed and your fingers are numb. Then gracias for all your trabajo. So vacate your shack, 'cause we're sending you back to where you come from. The pay is meager, you don't complain. In fact, you're eager, despite the pain. And if you're injured, what can you do? You should not be here, no, I won't shed a tear. So if you're not careful, you're through. So adios, señor mojado. Cutting expenses is hardly a sin. We're having a race to the bottom. We can do more for less. It's the key to success, and we know.
If you, I guess if you want to see what will happen to America, you can look at what Mr. Obama did in Chicago during his whole political career on the South Side there, basically being part of the group that was gentrifying the South Side. And this gentrification made enormous amounts of money by taking over land from the public sector and tearing down the houses on it and replacing public housing with much more valuable housing, and essentially driving the black population south.
Give it up. If you're gonna walk the earth, then
little rocket proud. And if you gonna say the word, got to say it loud. Say you gotta fight, fight, fight for your mind. You gotta fight, fight, fight for your mind. While you got the time, you got to fight, fight, fight for your mind. Gonna build a house, make it a home. If you're gonna pull some weight, oh, pull your own. If you're gonna help, man, just reach out your hand. If you're getting up, then take a stand. Said you gotta fight, fight, fight for your mind. Got to fight for your mind. Why you got time? You got to fight, fight for your mind.
You got to fight, fight, fight for your mind, mind, mind.